throttle. Circuit breakers in. We have separation. Inboard and outboard, they're on. We're coming forward with the side stick.
Oh, looks good.
Roger. I've got a blowout. Damper 3.
Pitch your pitch to zero.
Pitch is out. I can't hold altitude. Correction. Alpha 4 is on. Prep selected. Emergency. Flight calm. I can't hold it. She's breaking up. She's breaking.
Austin, astronaut, a man barely alive.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin will be that man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Palace of Glittering Delights, an internet radio show of which I am the host. And I am Andrew Leyland. What you just heard in lieu of the regular opening to this show were the opening credits to The $6 Million Man, one of the finest title credits in TV history. The $6 Million Man came along at just the right time, appearing as the embers of the Planet of the Apes franchise were dying away and just before Star Wars appeared. Adapted from Martin Caden's novel, Cyborg, The $6 Million Man was a resounding success with all, from the young to those that fancied actor Lee Majors. Every week, our titular hero would find himself in Mission Impossible-style scrapes, and every week he would use his bionics, and a touch of humanity, to escape. As this series was beaming into teleboxes all over the world, it was ripe for merchandising potential. And what potential there was. Every kid of the 70s had $6 Million Man merchandise, including me. I had the most prized of the $6 Million Man toys, the Steve Austin doll. Clad in red tracksuit and Adidas, this toy had a roll-up foreskin on its arm that tended to brittle after a while. Peel it down like a condom, and this revealed two circuit boards embedded in Austin's arm to represent his bionics. This was also ably represented by a large red button on his back. Now, because kids love a red button, this was just begging to be pressed, and doing so resulted in Steve's bionic arm juddering upwards in staccato movements to simulate his bionic feats of strength. This was especially impressive when one forced the engine block that came as an accessory into Steve's plastic hand. For all those 4 to 10 year olds, it was as if the TV show had come to life. Steve also had an unfortunate hole in the back of his head that, if you looked through it, simulated Steve's bionic eye, although on the toy, it made everything seem really far away rather than magnify the horizon. Despite the limitations of 70s technology, the likeness of Majors was really rather good, and the attention to detail was impressive. The clothes were real cloth, he had white socks that were easily lost, and there was a neat little $6 Million Man sticker on his breast, presumably so that on drunken nights out, Steve knew who he was. The show was at its height creatively in the first few years, but watching these now, there's an odd disconnect, as the familiar bionic sound effects are not in evidence. As the series moved on, and its popularity with children soared, some of the creative juice went out of the show, but a massive infusion of popularity was provided in the second season, with the introduction of Jamie Summers. Jamie was played with ineffable charm by Lindsay Wagner, who, in the show's continuity, was introduced as being Steve's high school sweetheart, despite being 10 years Lee Majors' junior. She was involved in her own accident, rebuilt as bionic herself, and then had a firmware malfunction and was returned to the manufacturer as faulty. There was uproar from the audience, who had come to love both Jamie and Wagner, whose innate likability made her eminently watchable. A return engagement was booked when Jamie's software received an upgrade, i.e. Wagner, then out of contract, was given a bathful of money to return. Jamie was resurrected even more successfully, and this return saw the Bionic Woman spun off into her own show. The Bionic Woman debuted in the July of 1976 in the UK on the ITV network. ITV had been having significant success with 6 Mil, a top 20 hit for the network, but the success of The Bionic Woman was unprecedented. The premiere episode was the second highest rated show of the week for ITV, and the highest rated drama, easily beating rivals the BBC. This success continued throughout the first season run, with The Bionic Woman breaking the top 10 consistently in the 3 months that the first season aired. There was loads of publicity, with Wagner receiving the cover of the kids' magazine Lookin' before the show even aired, and a number of times subsequently. Jamie was a phenomenon. Of course, she had her own doll. Unlike the Steve Austin model, it didn't really resemble Lindsay Wagner all that much. The actress herself has said it looked more like Farrah Fawcett, but it had the same attention to detail in the clothing, with Jamie clad in her white and blue tracksuit that she wears in a clip in the show's opening titles. As a kid, though, nothing was more excited than the crossover episodes, where Jamie and Steve teamed up for an adventure, and these are far rarer than you remember. As the movies are just discovering, and what comics have known for years, is that kids love their favourites being involved in a team-up of some fashion, and this was the case here. I loved seeing Jamie and Steve join forces, as it normally meant a mission so large it required both of them to complete it. My favourite of these crossover adventures is Kill Oscar, a three-part story which ran across two episodes of The Bionic Woman and one of The $6 Million Man. The first part of Kill Oscar has a brilliant cold open. John Houseman plays Dr. Franklin, who is working for some shady foreign power in an attempt to steal a weather machine being developed by the OSI, the agency that developed Steve and Jamie's bionics. We know they are a shady foreign power because the man they work for, played by the Incredible Hulk Jack Colvin, has a bizarre accent of indeterminate origin. Mr. McGee is here to oversee the project and is aghast when Houseman tells him he's been building funny robot women instead. Named Fembots, these almost perfect representations of women will infiltrate the OSI and steal the weather machine. Mr. McGee thinks this is all poppycock, but to prove their effectiveness, Houseman reveals that the leggy, hot pants-wearing ginger lady that has been showing him around is in fact a fembot. He demonstrates this by ripping her face off to show the distinctly 70s beep-de-beep workings underneath. It's pretty easy to mock this now, but I had nightmares about fembots' faces falling off as a kid. Between this and Westworld, it was hard to know who to trust. With this reveal out of the way, we're into the show. And here's the theme for this episode of The Bionic Woman. Here is because the theme music used on this episode is a one-off and isn't as good as the other version. I'm glad they changed it back. A couple of points about the credits. Martin E. Brooks has been given an opening credit position, the first Dr. Rudy Wells to be so honoured, despite being the third actor to play the role. Jennifer Darling is here as Peggy Callahan, Oscar Goldman's secretary, who had previously appeared only in The $6 Million Man, and in addition to Jack Colvin, noted character actor Jack Gink appears. Gink was a Stephen J. Cannell regular, as well as showing up in a number of Clint Eastwood westerns. He was the third military officer to chase the A-Team and the only character to ever be shot and die on screen in that show. Basically, if you watched a 70s or 80s TV show made by Universal, you know Gink's face. Harv Bennett is also credited as executive producer, despite having nothing to do with the Bionic Woman series. By all accounts, he never even went to the set. We are quickly informed that Houseman plans to swap out Dr. Wells's secretary with a fembot to steal the weather machine, a machine he thinks should be being used as the ultimate weapon rather than to aid humanity. That's pretty much the setup. 70s TV shows didn't waste any time getting to the point. Of course, he couldn't have chosen a worse time, as both Steve and Jamie happened to be at the OSI that day. Steve working on the weather machine, and Jamie there for a bionic upgrade. Wagner interacts with everybody in an easy and laid-back manner, effortlessly conveying the charm and appeal to the audience, and it's easy to see why she and the show became so popular. Sadly, this being the sexist 70s, she made more than a few enemies as well. The head of the network, infuriated that he paid so much money for her, wasn't a fan, and even Lee Majors' nose was put out of joint by the fact that Wagner was earning as much as he was. Still, on-screen Wagner is a joy, and there's a nice inversion of 70s sexism when Jamie saves Steve's ass when the weather machine pops a fuse. Steve, Jamie and Rudy are for pulling the plug, but Oscar, he say no. He's under pressure to make this thing work. The first thing we notice about Steve in this episode is that he's sporting his silly porn stash that Majors grew for the fourth season. David Soul had a top-lip caterpillar in Starsky and Hutch's fourth season as well, so maybe it was contractual. It can't be cosmetic, as it does not look good on either man. The plot progresses. Jamie's upgrades to her bionic ear are causing problems, and she starts hearing things. Things such as secretaries screaming for help, but when she approaches, there are no problems. She's also getting this weird vibe whenever she's near certain people. Of course, Jamie doesn't realise that Rudy's secretary has been fembotized, and, satisfied that the fembot can convince people that know them, Franklin proceeds to phase two, replacing Peggy Callahan. Of course, Callahan and Jamie have been having a heart-to-heart about their lives, and as such, when Callahan is replaced, Jamie smells a rat, or rather hears a funny squealing noise. There's a wonderfully 70s low-tech approach to all the computers that is glorious, with both Houseman and Wells's lab being all flashing lights and huge reel-to-reel tape machines. They are, of course, tracked with the blippity-blip-blip-blip sound effects straight out of the Universal Sound Effects Library labelled Futuristic Blippity-Blip Sound Effects. With Rudy unable to pinpoint the problem, Jamie recognises that it's happened twice. Once when Callahan was around, and once when Rudy's secretary was around, and they both start to ponder. Houseman, monitoring the conversation, realises Jamie is bionic and steps up his plan, kidnapping Oscar, a plan Jamie almost foils when she catches Wells' secretary in a lie. Of course, she fails, because if she succeeds, we don't have a three-part episode. John Houseman pops back up in his super 70s computer room of flashing disco lights, and we get some characterisation from the man. I also need to point out that Houseman must really like it hot, as the temperature in the room is pitched at boiling. Houseman is sweaty, Mr. McGee is sweaty, even the computers are sweaty. Anyway, Houseman reveals that he has serious grievances with the OSI, that they rejected his fembot technology in favour of bionics, and in not a terribly surprising reveal, it's also revealed that he's a raging misogynist. When, he purrs magnificently, was allowing a woman to think for herself a good thing. Well, Mr. Sweaty McGrumpy, you obviously reckoned without Jamie Summers. Still, with Oscar kidnapped, Oscar leaves a video blog stating that, in the event of his capture, he is to be terminated, and in case he's forced to talk, all of his cases to be closed down. Jamie is aghast. Jack Gink thinks that this is just part of the job. If he has to, he'll kill Oscar. Take a drink. Houseman is, of course, a villain in the 1970s mould and can't help but gloat, so he visits Oscar in their prison and tells them all about his plans to steal the weather machine and use it as a weapon. Oscar immediately recognises this as the plot to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, or he would if that movie had been made yet. Jamie, in the meantime, is annoyed that Oscar is being disregarded so cavalierly and calls Steve, asking him to disobey orders and arrange a rescue mission. Steve isn't convinced by Jamie's story, and because Jack Gink is playing the same character Jack Gink always plays, he's a stubborn mule and refuses to bend. So Jamie goes off book, drops by Callahan's apartment. She comfortably manoeuvres her into a trap, discussing things that fembot Callahan can't possibly know. Jamie's stunt double then gets into a fight with the fembots, which is quite cool in that low-budget 70s kind of way, and is forced to escape through a window that is too high for her bionics to tolerate, and she crashes to the floor, sparks flying from her ankles. This was actually a very lovely touch of verisimilitude. Kenneth Johnson, the producer and creator of The Bionic Woman, was quite a stickler for fantasy having grounded notions, and so there were limits to what Jamie's bionics could and couldn't do. A nice touch of realism that I always appreciate in my science fiction shows. Jamie apparently cannot jump down over 5 stories, but here has to leap from a 6th-story window. This causes her bionics to fritz upon landing, and Jamie ends up in hospital, unable to move. This conveniently takes Jamie out of the action, allowing Steve to pick up the plot in his own show. Part 1 is a great example of 70s TV, with all the good and bad that that implies. There are elements of redundancy and there is some padding, but the performances and general plot are interesting enough to keep it ticking along. It's on the production side where most of the problems are in evidence. There's a number of shots that are out of focus, and loads of scenes have been magnified to provide close-ups that weren't covered in the original shooting of the show. This makes lots of scenes look really grainy and blurry, especially on DVD. The picture quality of the second episode is much better, largely because it seems not to have been fiddled around with in post-production. As we are now a $6 million man episode, Jamie spends a lot of time in bed, leaving Steve to pick up the slack. Steve and Oscar listen to Jamie's tale of 2 fembots and ask her, "What's the frequency, Kenneth?" With the frequency of the fembots noted, they are able to track them back to the Super 70s computer room of flashing disco lights. As with all this is going on, I do wonder if Jamie being laid up in bed is a product of Lindsay Wagner's notorious stamina, or lack thereof. Apparently working days on The Bionic Woman were 8 for every episode, as opposed to the 7 days of other shows, largely due to Lindsay Wagner simply being too tired to work that punishing schedule. Having her film an extra episode probably made her come out in hives, so I can imagine that the conversation went something like this.
"Hey, Lindsay, we're doing an extra show this week."
"But I want to go home."
"Get to spend the entire show in bed."
"Okay." Anyway, because this is 1970s TV, the computer takes ages to track down the location, but after a montage of satellites in space, whirling reel-to-reels and computers doing 70s computer stuff, Steve locates the base, and we get a pretty cool fight between Steve and the fembots. Steve is offered the opportunity to surrender, but instead smashes the satellite receiver, which causes the fembots to comically start blundering around, walking into walls and each other. Steve then rescues Oscar and Rudy's secretary, and they make a run for it. They believe Callahan to be dead, just before you think Steve doesn't care about Oscar's beleaguered secretary. Houseman blows up the base because it's 70s sci-fi and heads to his backup base, because every good megalomaniac has a backup base, whilst Oscar is returned home to have one of his patented conversations with Mr. Secretary. However, it's not all over. Steve's helicopter struggles to take off after rescuing Oscar and Rudy's secretary due to unbalanced weight issues. And later, Rudy reveals that the fembots are like super heavy, man. He pays it no mind in the rush to escape, but later, back in Oscar's office, Steve spots Oscar has stepped on a pencil and crushed it. Granted, the floorboards are also creaking, but this is rather flimsy evidence to bait Steve's sudden leap, bionically I'm sure, to the conclusion that Oscar is a fembot, or whatever the male equivalent would be. A he-bot? So does this mean Houseman thinks men shouldn't be allowed to think for themselves either? Anyway, Oscar Robot Man orders Steve to Hawaii, and when Steve disobeys, Houseman thinks Steve is onto him. He's completely oblivious to the fact that Steve rarely follows Oscar's orders, and ironically, this is his undoing. If he'd known Steve did this all the time, maybe his plan would have worked. Anyway, he doesn't know this, so Oscar Robot Man then tells the security people that Steve is a robot. Which of course he is. I mean, he's not a he-bot like Oscar, but when Jack Gink scans Steve's legs with his magnificent 70s Spot If Your Friend's a Robot toy, it does reveal that Steve's a cyborg. Which he is. This is actually quite clever of Houseman to subvert what Gink is looking for. Steve would show up on the 70s Spot If Your Friend's a Robot toy as a cyborg entity. Anyway, Steve escapes, because he's Steve, in a really rather cool scene where Lee Majors jumps on the back of a moving van and then leaps off it over a wall. Fair play to Majors here for doing all of his own stunts, and they are quite impressive. Steve heads back to Rudy as Houseman decides to eliminate Steve with Oscar Robot Man. Rudy and Steve have allowed for this, and it's Steve versus an Oscar robot for the second time in the series. Steve kicks Oscar's face off after a pretty good fight, where again Majors does a lot of his own stunts. With the face ripped off, Steve manages to overpower the Oscar robot by ripping out the batteries, and all's well that ends well. kind of. I want to know what happened to Mr. McGee. Back at the hospital, and just in time to make it to our own show, Jamie makes a remarkable recovery. Just in time to see a hurricane a-blowing. See, Houseman has managed to get hold of the weather machine, and with this, we are to be continued. Part 2 was actually better than Part 1. I think because there was more action, but also because the plot moved along at quite a clip as well. Middle parts normally slow down a bit, but with all the setup out of the way, Kill Oscar Part 2 moves along quite well, introducing new problems and wrapping up old ones satisfactorily. Sideliming Jamie is a bit unfortunate, but there's a good reason for it, and the viewer is amped up for Part 3, which is back over on the Barnet Woman. After news broadcaster Howard K. Smith shows us some stock footage of bad weather, supposed to represent John Houseman's weather machine, Rudy gives Jamie a clean bill of health, and she and Steve are briefed on Jack Gink's plan via the 70s version of PowerPoint, which is a series of badly presented slides with really garish coloured backgrounds. This is not a successful class. Gink would not be rated highly by the Ofsted board. Anyway, Oscar is considered expendable, and an attack on Houseman's new base is ordered. Jamie is understandably upset at this, and via another extensive montage of stock footage, we see Army and Air Force personnel prepare for the attack. Steve and Jamie interrupt the stock footage to convince an old naval friend of Oscar's to lend them the keys to a nuclear submarine, which he does after they demonstrate their bionics, and then we get another montage of stock footage, this time of submarines and radar. The Bionic Woman was frequently the more charming and whimsical of the two series, and this is evident from the start of Kill Oscar Part 3. Jamie and Steve showing the old Admiral their bionics is not without humour, and was but one of the many times they took it on themselves to trust an OSI agent with their secret. These conversations normally went something like this. What clearance are you? I'm a level 4. Well, now you're a 9. As with Part 1, the director makes a lot of odd choices, not least of which is having the edges of the screen blurry whenever he cuts to Fembot Lur, like he's shooting the scene through one of those old 70s kaleidoscope things. It's a peculiar choice and a very distracting one. Steve and Jamie are launched from the sub in scuba suits to the island of Dr. Houseman, and Jamie is spotted as she swims ashore. From this point on, it's all pretty action-orientated, which in this show consists of lots of running in slow-mo. It's not badly done, but there are, again, liberal dollops of stock footage to pad out the running time and try and make the show look more expensive. This rarely succeeds in series of this vintage, as the quality of the stock varies wildly from pretty good to god-awful. Sadly, it's the god-awful that is highlighted terribly on the DVD versions of these shows. Still, there's a lot of bionic action in this concluding part, with Jamie and Steve separated for a lot of the second act, presumably because this is Jamie's show. There are places where the action could be tightened up, and the Fembots aren't quite up there with Bigfoot, or even Death Probe, but they were one of the more memorable adversaries Jamie met, long before Austin Powers made them a permanent part of pop culture. There is then a lot of chasing Steve and Jamie around. Steve, presumably for the ladies, strips down to really short shorts. With his four-season porn stash, he really looks like a strippogram. Steve and Jamie then fight Mother Nature, represented by floods and storms, and the corruption of nature, represented by the Fembots. Sadly, it's all wrapped up rather unsatisfactorily, with lots of looped dialogue that seems to be there to over-explain the plot for those that are not paying attention. Houseman simply lets Oscar and Callahan go and prepares to go down with his creations, but Jamie rescues him, despite his rampant sexism. It all wraps up rather neatly and everybody has a buddy-buddy moment at the end that seems very out of place with the tone of the rest of the piece. The third part is therefore a disappointment compared to the previous two. By taking this weather machine and perverting it into a deadly weapon, John Houseman has been built up, over the three shows, as a credible threat to the entire world. And the build-up, with this requiring both Steve and Jamie to stop him, made the first two parts seem special. The third part, unfortunately, does not live up to its potential. It's a lot of running around rather than action, with Lindsay Wagner battling a wind machine rather than Fembots. Houseman doesn't really learn anything and is treated as a pal and a friend in the conclusion rather than the maniac he was presented as being in the setup. All that being said, Kill Oscar is everything you remember about the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman, and in that regard is a pleasant diversion. There are memorable villains in the Fembots, bionic action with the traditional sound effects we mimicked as kids, and a pleasing and endearing performance from Wagner. I'm not going to lie to you and say it holds up or can go toe-to-toe with the TV of today. It doesn't and can't. It's clearly the TV of a bygone era, but it is fun and entertaining. This is a beautiful nostalgia trip on that level alone. If you're one of those people who grew up with this, it'll give you the warm funnies, even if you find your attention drifting to your phone as you watch it. If you're a younger person who can appreciate the older stuff for what it is, you may also get a kick out of this. For me, it was a bionic slice of heaven. It's just silly enough, just cheesy enough, without falling over into parody. The stakes feel real even amidst the cheese, and the tone of the piece is well balanced. Sadly, behind-the-scenes shenanigans interfered with the show from this point forth, and this would be the last time we saw Steve and Jamie interact together on television until the TV reunion movies of the late 1980s. As I mentioned earlier, Wagner's salary demands led to the head of the network, Fred Silverman, having a severe beef with the show, because, God forbid, women should be paid as much as men. A slight dip in the ratings towards the end of season two was all he needed to cancel the show on ABC. However, The Bionic Woman was still a smash by any yardstick, and NBC swooped in and picked the series up for the 1977-78 season. Changes had to be made, however. ABC was not about to let the star of one of their biggest shows, Lee Majors, appear on a rival network, so the romance between Steve and Jamie was dropped, and he was, apart from a brief mention in the first episode, never seen or referred to again. Oscar Goldman and Rudy Wells were allowed to appear, giving both actors the opportunity to play the same characters on different shows on competing networks. The Fembots proved popular, though, and, as with all popular villains in these shows, they were brought back, this time for the third season two-part adventure Fembots in Las Vegas. Because I played the alternative opening credits a couple of minutes ago, we will indulge ourselves by playing the proper opening credit Bionic Woman theme right now. Problem with The Bionic Woman is it didn't really have a memorable theme. That's quite bland and uninteresting, even though it is, as I said, better than the alternate that we just listened to earlier. We open Fembots in Las Vegas with Jamie visiting Oscar. And see, Oscar is doing the 70s equivalent of watching his old DVDs. He's going over old case files. Amidst the remnants of old episodes, though, looking more than a little creepy, is a Fembot. Jamie has a flashback to kill Oscar to remind the audience what a Fembot is, and creeped out by even being in the same room she and Oscar leave. Oscar tells Jamie she has nothing to worry about, as Dr. Franklin died in jail, which means they couldn't afford to get John Houseman back. Callahan also drops by for a chat, Jennifer Darling having had a delightful new haircut, and she too reminisces about the Fembots, especially as this one bears her likeness. All of this chatter would be for naught if the Fembots weren't preparing to rise again, and to nobody's surprise, the Fembot is rebooted over the Wi-Fi, and disembodied voice tells her to put her face on and take the real Callahan's place. The trio then drop by Rudy, and he delivers some lines about the Russians and energy weapons and other guff, but really, this is a sweeps week episode, so everybody is off to Vegas. This is an excuse for lots of stock footage of 70s Las Vegas and shots of the actors driving around Sunset Strip so as to scream, "We went on location!" Joe Harnell also dusts off his Stop Susan Williams theme that he also recycled for The Incredible Hulk. Jamie and Oscar take in a dancing girl show, which is just about the unsexiest thing I've ever seen, despite the amount of flesh on display. Really, it's poorly choreographed and just so cheesy. Is this what Las Vegas is really like? Oscar recognises one of the girls as the girlfriend of the man he's trying to speak to, but who is, apparently, a notorious recluse. Jamie is sent backstage to chat to her, but Jamie is distracted when she hears the Fembot frequency in her bionic ear. So to blend in, Jamie Summers, feminist icon and role model for girls the world over, dresses in a dancing girl's costume. To be fair, she's wearing a mask, so that protects her dignity somewhat. These people seem to have little concept of going undercover. If I may indulge in some sexist piggery for but a second, Miss Wagner does have the legs for this costume, even if she doesn't actually do any dancing. I had thought we were going to learn that Jamie could add chorus girl to her resume of talents. Jamie ditches the costume quite quickly. So quickly, I'm willing to bet that it was only in the script so they could get some footage of Lindsay Wagner in that costume for the promos. Jamie reports to Oscar that the girl is a fembot. Oscar refuses to believe Jamie, which makes no sense. All the times that Jamie has been proven correct, and he simply dismisses her. Jamie decides to do what Jamie always does. She investigates herself. This involves lots of walking up and down beige and brown corridors and opening doors in an effort to pad out the plot. Jamie finds Fembot number one and she locates a man called Rod, who has a disease that means he has to live in a bubble to protect his immune system. Rod doesn't seem aware that the woman is a Fembot and calls off their relationship for her sake. She says she will return tomorrow, but also professes her love for Rod, something a Fembot shouldn't be able to do. Jamie overhears all of this and hightails it back down the beige corridors and opens even more doors before she is twigged by the new boss of the Fembots, the son of Dr. Franklin, who looks a lot like a young James Spader. They lure Jamie into an abandoned room and suddenly it's when Fembots attack. This is actually a pretty great fight scene. It's tracked with a magnificent 70s jazz mix and liberal use of the bionic sound effects. Jamie takes Fembot 1's face off and runs for it down the strip, where Fembot 1, who was never taught how to cross roads, is hit by a car. Again, really good demonstration of 70s stunt work when the Fembot hitting the car crashes to the floor and explodes in a fireworks display of sparks. Good as this stunt is, I was incredibly distracted by how low-cut Lindsay Wagner's blouse was. Seriously, it's open to her belly button. I know it was the 70s and everybody opened their shirts to their belt buckle, but I was captivated by this, largely because I did have a huge crush on Lindsay Wagner as a child, even though I didn't quite know what that meant at the time, not being really old enough. Rudy analyses the Fembot and they realise that Dr. Franklin II is trying to get at Rod for the same reason Oscar is, and they vow to stop him. They're not aware that Callahan is a Fembot, as Franklin II has changed the frequency they operate on, and Franklin watches everything, musing that the three people who destroyed my father are in that room, completely ignoring Steve, because he's on another network now. We can tell the difference between John Houseman's Fembots and Junior's Fembots, as Houseman sported hot pants, and this lot are all more modern, sporting chokers, knee-high boots and flowery chiffon skirts that are very short. Anyway, these Charlie's Angels models of Fembot attack Rod, knock out Jamie and Oscar, who have also come to talk to the man, and take off. Of course, the Fembots order Rod's energy weapon device MacGuffin thing turned over to them. Jamie awakens, and it's her versus the Fembots round two. This fight scene is weird, in that in addition to the usual slow-motion bionics, the producers chose to speed up some footage. There's this weird disconnect as the sped-up footage suddenly becomes slow-motion and back again. It's very odd. There's more door opening and closing and more corridors as Jamie gets Rod to a helicopter. And then in one of the best stunts in the series, Jamie leaps off the building and catches the landing strut of the helicopter. This was for real. As the stunt double holds on for dear life, the camera pulls back to see that she really is clinging to a landing strut as the helicopter takes off from the roof of the building and flies over Vegas. These stunt women had some huge balls. Jamie climbs in and, in a really funny moment, after all she's just done, Rod tells her to fasten her seatbelt. Wagner's facial reaction is hysterically funny. The Fembots manage to get a hold of the energy weapon and Jamie and Rod arrive too late. Franklin Jr. says they are ready for phase two, and then we get some brief setup for the next episode. The energy weapon is attached to a space booster that Rudy just happens to be using for some telescope project. Oscar tries to suspend the launch, but it's too late. The Fembots have taken over the control room. Part 2 picks up where part 1 left off, but takes forever to actually get going. There's loads of shots of the base where the launch is taking place, and back and forth between Oscar, traffic control, and Rod and Jamie preparing to land, all of which could be cut to get Jamie to the base as soon as possible. When they do eventually land, Jamie must elude base security, as Jamie is unaware that the Fembots control the base. They attack Jamie, and they're now wearing a nice line in different coloured pantsuits. Again, the fights are pretty good. Jamie's stunt double does most of the work, and I assume that two of the Fembots are also stunt doubles rather than actresses, as they are both quite statuesque and Amazonian compared to the slender Jamie and petite Peggy Callahan. Jamie hits a wall and he's back in a hospital bed. Rod, Oscar and Rudy are helpless as Franklin Jr.'s space shuttle thing is now in orbit, and Rod is unable to stop it or bring it down. It's at this point we realise that part two of this story is symptomatic of many two-part stories. Part 1 had a brilliant setup, but then Part 2 just doesn't deliver on that promise. We're 25 minutes into Part 2, and there has been very little plot progression, with Oscar hanging around at a computer, looking at screens and taking his glasses off a lot. Jamie sidelined in bed again, and loads of stock footage is used to demonstrate the enormous power of the energy weapon, some of which looks like it was robbed from a 3D movie, as there are blurry red and green lines around the rocks. Following this, Franklin delivers his ultimatum. He wants two things. Firstly, the three people who destroyed Daddy, Jamie, Oscar, and Rudy. In addition to, once again forgetting Steve, he forgets to tell us what the second thing that he wants is. There's some added drama as Rod's condition could lead to death at any moment, but Rudy and Oscar turn themselves over to Franklin and forbid Jamie from following them. They forbid the bionic woman from following them. Rudy actually says,
"Do as you're told this time."
I have to say, if I was Jamie, I'd be going after them just to stuff those words down Rudy's throat. Jamie makes Rod think, damn it, and he works out that if the weapon could be fired at its own targeting unit, it would destroy that unit. Jamie would need to be in the base to do this, and it's a long shot, but it just might work. The acting and direction in this scene isn't great. Rod seems to blunder his lines, having to take great pauses to remember his dialogue, and even Wagner stumbles over all the techno babble. The producers also repeat that trick from Kill Oscar of zooming in on already shot footage, a horrible decision that just makes everything look out of focus and gives the impression the director is inept. Jamie, now fully recovered, hightails it to the base, and we get a magnificent Bond line from Franklin Jr. in "I've been expecting you, Miss Summers," before we launch into Act 3. Jamie is put in the same cell as Oscar and Rudy, and she explains Rod's plan, which involves placing a cassette tape into the system, which I presume is the same as popping a USB and uploading a virus nowadays. Jamie says she will offer a distraction by luring the Fembots away and then running like hell. This scene plays out like the end of Diamonds Are Forever, where Jill St. John essentially had to do the same thing to Blofeld's computers. Jamie initiates her plan and then legs it. This must be serious, as Franklin sends four Fembots after her this time rather than the same three we've seen previously. Rudy and Oscar plant the tape by having Oscar push Franklin out of a door. That was remarkably easy. I knew there was a reason doors featured so heavily in this episode. They also managed to shut down all the Fembots. All but one. In a last-minute reveal, Franklin Jr. is revealed to be a He-Bot. Jamie offers to face Spader-Bot in a fight to the death to finally prove which is better, Franklin's monsters or Rudy's bionics. It's a bionic showdown that Jamie wins by luring Spader-Bot to the roof and sidestepping when he runs at her, causing him to simply fall over the edge of the building and plunge to his doom. With the countdown activated, Jamie slides down the elevator cables to escape and gets out just in time, accompanied by more jazzy 70s funk. As with all truly great 70s science fiction, it ends with a big explosion. This is actually a pretty good last act. Ignoring how Jamie can slide down the elevator cable with both hands when she only actually has one bionic arm, the ending is quite tense and well shot, with again some impressive stunt work. One of the things the bionic series didn't skimp on was the good stunts. Yes, Spader-Bot's fall is cheesy, but the Fembots are cheesy. There's nothing wrong with a good slice of cheese every now and again. It's all wrapped up with Rod back in his bubble, although there is apparently now a hope for a cure, and Jamie, Callahan, Oscar and Rudy yuck it up in a Vegas casino. Fembots in Las Vegas is gloriously silly, yet enormous fun. Part 1 is much better than Part 2, not least because there's barely any Las Vegas in Part 2, rendering the title moot. The Fembots are a pretty cool villain, though, coming across as the Terminator before there was a Terminator, and pitting these automatons against Jamie is nifty, as Jamie is well out of her league. As with Kill Oscar, there's a metric ton of padding, the over-reliance of stock footage again grows tiresome, and the budget strings show in ways I didn't really see as a kid, but the Bionic Woman is still a lot of fun. Jamie constantly having to battle the rampant sexism of the men is a running subtext. Can you imagine Rudy packing patronisingly telling Steve Austin to obey orders for once, or Oscar calling Steve Babe after every line. Still, Wagner's good value, even when she's surrounded by shonky plots. For more information on the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman, I urge you to check out a couple of other sources available on your interwebs. Firstly, Cyborgs, a Bionic podcast, which is hosted by John S. Drew and Paul K. Bisson, is well worth your time. One of the best podcasts out there. John S. Drew also hosts the OSI Files, a spin-off of Cyborgs, in which he delves in deeper into specific episodes of Bionic lore. That is also worth listening to. There's also a magnificent website called Bionic Blonde, which goes over every single episode of The Bionic Woman in some of the funniest summaries of any television show I've ever read. That is also well worth checking out. Again, if you want me to cover any more Bionic stuff, or you have any suggestions for stuff for this show, feel free to email in at heykidscomics@virginmedia.com. There's a couple of things that we do want to mention before I plunge into the email back. There's a couple of you out there who were no doubt expecting that the follow-up to my Lee Ditko Spider-Man episode would be part two of my Lee Ditko Spider-Man episodes. That would be a fair assessment. However, those shows are taking a long time to actually do. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm poring over every panel in those comics, so that it is coming along, it is being written, and it will be with you as soon as it's ready. Speaking of heykidscomics@virginmedia.com, let's have a look at a couple of emails. Only two this time, but that's fine, that's okay. Neil Stanifer has emailed in with this episode scored, which is talking about the movie-themed episode I did a couple of weeks ago. Dear Maestro Leyland, thanks for turning your attention to film scores in your most recent Palace of Glittering Delights. As a lover of the film score myself, I'm always pleased to hear another listener's take on what makes for a good, effective film score. I found nothing in your reviews or commentary with which to disagree, so perhaps I should just stop here. Alas, that is not in my nature, so instead I'll ramble on with a couple of questions for you. First, do you ever find your appreciation for a score, as opposed to a title theme, diminished when the score is taken out of its cinematic context? I'm aware that the reverse can be true, that a score can easily be the best thing a film has to offer, well capable of standing on its own legs, as you pointed out. But I'm thinking of scores such as Howard Shore's music for Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, or perhaps James Newton Howard's work for Unbreakable. Both were magnificent works in their cinematic context, but I find they just lie around the house when I get them home, pining for the fjords, perhaps. Or is there something to be admired about the weaving of a score into the action of a film so the score requires the visuals to justify itself? Well, first of all, that's a very good question. I recently watched Under the Skin, which was a Scarlett Johansson film. Very low-budget science fiction movie set in Scotland. The score to that is essentially just somebody screeching on a violin throughout the entire film. And whilst it perfectly suits the movie, I can't imagine listening to that on its own for pleasure. So there certainly is evidence of scores not working when you take them out of context. I think that about Zimmerman. Hans Zimmerman scores for Christopher Nolan's Batman films as well. I think they're perfectly fine in the film, but boring as hell if you try and listen to them in isolation. I don't know. I think there is something to be said for film scores that do track the film perfectly. But as somebody who grew up with, like, John Barry and John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith, I do think that the music working independently as a piece of music is probably trickier to pull off. Certainly shows like $6 Million Man had very good scores, certainly in the early days by Oliver Nelson, and, of course, the original Star Trek. The music to that show works on its own. So I would always go in the side that I like the music and the soundtrack to be listenable on its own, as opposed to something that only works in the context of the movie, which I think is what you're asking. Neil also has a second question. What about those bits of a score that are just plain odd in context or out? I thoroughly enjoy Christopher Young's scores, especially when he indulges his experimental side in films like Hellraiser, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, or even Sinister. However, friends of mine sometimes insist that such scores are merely an adjunct of the sound effects track, or worse, self-indulgent twaddle.
I fail to see how some people can look down on this sort of experimentation while extolling the virtues of a classic score such as Forbidden Planet, executed entirely through electronic tones. I'm often tempted to hoist them by their hipster beards and defenestrate them, but instead I just put on J. Ralph's score to Lucky Number 11, crank it up, and rip off the knobs. Any thoughts on these questions? All the best. Neil Stanifer. Yeah, again, Forbidden Planet. I love Forbidden Planet. I think it's brilliant. I cannot listen to that score on its own, because it is, like you say, it's just blippity blip, 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 all the way through. That's not really a score in the true sense of the word. It's certainly not a soundtrack score, even if it does perfectly accompany the film. In terms of experimental, I still prefer stuff that stands on its own. One of mine is Philip Glass's soundtrack to Kind of Scatter, which really does get under your skin and work as an independent piece. But when you track it with the visuals from that film, it's sublime. It's a wonderful piece of work. I do agree that it does sometimes come across as just being additional sound effects. But if that's what works for the film, then that's what works for the film. It's as simple as that. Thank you for emailing in, Neil. There were two good questions there. Glad you emailed in. Food for thought. Chris Franklin also emailed in with the Palace of Lee Ditko delights. Now you're talking. I know I've mentioned before how those 80s Marvel Tales reprints were hugely important to me growing up, so I won't bother mentioning it again. Needless to say, I'm in full agreement of you. With you. You bring up an interesting point with Spidey being more thought out than his Marvel Age peers. Was Ditko the X Factor, though? He almost had to be. You could argue that Kerbo had a heavier hand in the Strange Tales stories as well, since Lee and Ditko would surely know better when it came to Spidey. Other than a few misfires, the early Spidey story should be studied by any creator looking to launch a superhero comic. This is how it's done. Yeah, I think Ditko undeniably is the X Factor. I really do. As we record this, as I say, I'm writing part 2, and I'm up to around issue 11 or 12, and the plotting is just so much stronger in those Ditko Spider-Man issues than it is in Kirby's offerings. And I know it's probably going to put a cat amongst certain pigeons, but I have come to the conclusion that Ditko is a better plotter than Kirby. His stories hang together better. There's setup and payoff, which rarely happened in a Kirby plotted story. There's an awful lot of issues of the Fantastic Four where the Deus Ex Machina at the end just comes out of nowhere. That rarely happens in Ditko's stuff. Ditko sets up things early on and then pays them off in the conclusion. Spider-Man using that inverter when he took down the Vulture doesn't just come out of nowhere. Peter is seen clearly tinkering around with it earlier on in the issue. And the fact that Ditko plotted subplots to run from issue to issue far better than Kirby or even Lee did on his own in the early days, the Betty Brant subplot that leads into the Dr. Octopus two-parter with Bennett Brant is a prime example of that. Kirby and Lee weren't doing anything like that, and certainly Strange Tales was just pants, whoever the plotter was. So yeah, Ditko is very definitely the X Factor in those early Spider-Man strips, which isn't taken away from Lee's contribution. But there is just something about the first 40 issues of Spider-Man that is, it's demonstrably better in terms of how it's plotted, in terms of how it's written, in terms of how each issue bleeds into the next one while still remaining a single cohesive standalone story that isn't present in the books that Lee wasn't doing with him. So, yeah, Ditko's the X Factor. I don't think there's any denying. Chris continues, yes, I fully expect that Trek music episode after Lee Ditko would be fine. Great first episode in the series, can't wait for more, Chris. Well, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer, because as I said, this Bionic episode just took precedence. It just came about, I was off on holiday for a week, I fancied watching some cheesy 70s sci-fi. $6 Million Man, The Bionic Woman, a glorious cheesy 70s sci-fi. So that's where this one came from. Up next, probably Lee Ditko part 2. But I don't know for sure. Obviously, like I said, that's taking a little bit longer. What I may do is not do as many issues per show. Certainly, I felt that 2 hours for that one, 2 hours of me rambling was a little bit much, I felt. So I may do maybe only 5 comics per show instead of 8 or 9. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. Whatever it is, I hope you'll join us next time. As I say, I can be emailed on heykidscomics@virginmedia.com.
if you have anything to say about this or any other episode. And remember, if you visit the twotruefreaks.com webpage, there's a little Amazon button. And if you click on that, it'll take you to Amazon. You can buy stuff. It doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't add anything to your account. But it does give us a little bit of a kickback, which keeps the website going. Thank you very much for joining me. And I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.